Hi, this is Bob Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope magazine.
This is Dmitry Sasolov. I'm a professor of astronomy at Harvard.
Hi, this is Sarah Seeger. I'm a professor of planetary science and physics at MIT.
And I'm Alan McRobert, one of Sky and Telescope's senior editors. Now, could we just start off by each of you describing your work?
Well, let me start. I began as a stellar astronomer, studying the physics of stars, mostly variable stars. And then when planets around other stars were discovered, this became really my main topic of research. I'm mostly a theorist, so I'm interested what these planets are made of, what their atmospheres might be. But I'm also interested in detection, in being able to find them and characterize them.
I was in graduate school when exoplanets were first discovered around sun-like stars. And Dimitar was also there, and he was my thesis supervisor. And so together, we were among the first people to work on exoplanets to try to understand their atmospheres. And I've now extended that work to do computer models of atmospheres and interiors, and now biosignatures of planets like Earth and super-Earths, covering all masses of planets possible.
And may I also interject and say that there were a lot of skeptics at the time who were telling both Sarah and myself that you shouldn't be doing that. That's too difficult. It won't work. And Sarah did a brilliant job on it.
And the pendulum has somewhat swung the other way now, where now even crazy work on exoplanets is basically considered acceptable.
Yes.
When you look back over the last 10 or 15 years since the first planets around sun-like stars were found in the mid-90s, you know, I've been kind of amazed the number of known planets is over 300 now. Just looking at the planets that have been found to date, what have been some of the most valuable lessons that have been learned about the nature of planets and planetary systems around other stars?
I think we have to start by saying that so many surprising things were found that now we want to say expect the unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and just wait until Kepler is in orbit. The number of exoplanets known, discovered, will explode to 1,000 or maybe several thousand.
And Kepler is going up when?
Currently, we are scheduled for the 4th of March, 2009. So we are counting the days to launch.
And how exactly will Kepler find extrasolar planets, and what kind of planets will it find?
Well, right now, Kepler is using the transit method. Transits are planets that go in front of their star as seen from Earth. And right now, I would say this is the leading method for characterizing planets, that is, learning about their radii and getting their masses. So Kepler will look at one field of stars for over 3 years to look for transits.
And as I understand it, that field will have something like 100,000 stars.
Yes, the field will have several million stars, but we are going to download data only for about 120,000 of them. And the reason for that is that Kepler is in orbit around the Sun, so it's very expensive to download the entire field. And it's actually not necessary to download the entire field because there are a lot of red giants and binary stars that are not going to allow us to detect transiting planets around them. So the 100,000 or so stars are going to be the ones that we monitor precisely.
And Kepler, with its enormous CCD field of view, is going to be measuring the brightnesses of these 100,000 stars. What is it, once every 30 minutes for at least 3.5 years, maybe 10 years continuously, to an accuracy of 1 part in 10,000, is that right?
It's almost right. That is, Kepler is going, going to be the main mode for Kepler's observing, but not the only one. All stars will be observed with an exposure of 30 minutes. But a fair fraction of them, 1,000 or more, will be set to be observed with an exposure of only 1 minute. That is, a lot more observations will be taken for specially designated stars. And the ones that we have detected interesting planets orbiting them will be shifted to that category so that we get better light curves.
And what sort of planets do you expect or hope to find?
Well, the goal of Kepler is to take a census of Earths. How common are planets just like our Earth? Earth size in Earth-like orbits. And that's the major goal. And that's why we're so excited about Kepler. But if Kepler is designed to find these very small planets in somewhat distant orbits, 1-year orbits, it can find everything else that's bigger and closer to the star. So ultimately, we expect Kepler to find lots and lots of super-Earth exoplanets transiting their star.
Although out of these 100,000 planets, only a small fraction are going to have planets that just happen to orbit in the plane of our line of sight so that transits happen at all. How many detections do you think it will make? I've seen estimates of anywhere from 40 to 600 Earths or super-Earths.
Okay, so that's indeed the projection. So Kepler is built in order to find out what the real number is. But we project on the basis of what we know today. And what we know today is that about 10% of all the stars that we see in the near neighborhood have giant planets somewhere in the vicinity of 1 to 10 AU. And then it seems that three times more, about 30% of such stars have actually smaller planets, super-Earths and mini-Neptunes. So the question then is, if we project those numbers, what do we get for Kepler? And what we currently get for Kepler is about 40 to 50 Earth-like planets, 1 to 2 Earth masses in the habitable zone, about 300 to 500 Earth-like planets at other orbits, much closer to their stars, and about 1,000 or so bigger giant planets.
My understanding is with Kepler, you'll build up a very good statistical base to get a real handle on the number of Earth-sized planets around stars, but a lot of these are very distant, fairly faint stars. Is there any chance of actually maybe doing follow-up studies on these planets discovered with Kepler to see if any of them might have atmospheres indicative of life, or for that do you kind of need to look more at closer stars?
Well, for the bigger planets, the Jupiter-sized one, there's no question that we can do a lot of follow-up of pretty much any kind that you want to, atmosphere, size, mass, etc. For the smaller planets, it'll be more and more difficult the smaller the planet gets and the fainter the star is. So Kepler's main goal remains to just do a census to tell us how common are other planets like Earth.
And I understand, Sarah, that you are on this task force to develop a strategy for eventually detecting life-bearing planets. How will the results from Kepler help guide our future strategy to get to that really great goal?
The really great goal is so incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. It involves going to space and perhaps doing astrometry to find targets and doing direct imaging to block out the light of the star, where the star is 10 billion times brighter than the planet.
And actually getting and separating light from the planet,
spatially
getting
separating
actually
them,
an actual little blue dot. Mm-hmm.
That's right. It's so difficult, but the kind of telescope you want to build does depend on how common Earths are. Let's say Kepler comes back and says every single star, or 90% of stars, have a planet Earth-sized in an Earth-like orbit. This is great, because it means that this big telescope we want to build doesn't have to be so huge, because we know that almost every star we look at will have an Earth. What if Kepler comes back and says Earths are very rare? Perhaps they only detected one that might be like Earth-sized Earth orbit. Then we have to rethink plans, and the sort of canonical design that's being considered will not do the job. Mm-hmm. So actually the number is quite important for us.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, this is the main value of Kepler, and that's why NASA selected it even many years ago before those estimates could be very secure. But I want to tell you that Kepler is going to achieve even more than that, mm-hmm. because we also want to understand what is the diversity of these planets, how many of them are in different orbits, how many of them are probably made mostly of rock, how many of them are mostly made of water. And that Kepler can deliver as well, because it is going to pinpoint the candidates for us, measure the radius and the orbit, and then for some of them, the bigger super-Earths, we will be able to measure masses. Mm-hmm. We didn't think so 10 years ago, but now we've come to the technology to be able to accomplish this even for the fainter stars that Kepler will discover.
This is by the wobble that their gravity induces in their star, and you can measure the radial velocity changes. What is the limit to that? How low mass a planet can you detect or confirm with that method?
Well, let me start by saying what is the limit in terms of wobble. Currently, the best measurements allow you to go a little bit better than 1 meter per second in Doppler shift velocity wobble.
An easy mosey along the sidewalk, and we're talking about astronomical, in the midst of astronomical velocities, the Earth's rotation, the Earth's orbit around the Sun's motion through the galaxy, the other stars' motion through the galaxy, all of this stuff, once that's subtracted out, you can measure down to a meter per second, the difference between velocity between your telescope, barycenter of the solar system, and the star's surface.
You can, and it's amazing, isn't it? But it's still not enough. If you want to measure the effect that the Earth has on the Sun, the wobble of the Sun due to the Earth as a planet, it's only 10 centimeters per second. So it's 10 times less than what we are talking about. And this is where you need to have new technology and to understand the stars better in order to reach that. But I think by the time Kepler gives us some of those planets, we'll be almost there.
Almost down to 10 centimeters per second. Almost. And at that point, if the instruments get good enough, at what point do the instruments get too good, that they're measuring nothing but noise in the velocity data of the stars? At what point are the stars just too noisy in terms of their surface motions?
Typical stars like the Sun have noise which is of the order of 30 to 50 centimeters per second. But most of it is noise which is, we would call it coherent. It's due to waves which we understand and we could subtract out. So we hope that we can actually go down to 1 centimeter per second.
1 centimeter per second. So now you've got the diameter of the planets by the amount of light they block when they transit. You've got the mass of them by the radial velocity method. And when you have the mass of something and its size, its volume, that gives you the density. What will this tell about the nature of a planet?
Well, the average density can tell us a lot. We really want to discriminate between a planet that is made almost entirely of rock, so that it has a surface where life could form and exist.
Like Earth,
with a thin atmosphere. We want to discriminate between a rocky planet and a planet that has a huge hydrogen-helium envelope that would create very high temperatures and pressures at any surface.
And we Uranus and Neptune,
or even mini Uranuses and mini Neptunes. Maybe not so much. They have 10% by mass of hydrogen and helium. So first of all, we will be able to rule that kind of thing out. Mm. But more than that, it gets a little more tricky. And work that Dimitar has done and myself try to show what exactly can you tell. The problem is we have an average density, which is good. We don't know how the density is distributed in the planet. Is there a huge dense core followed by a lighter outer layer or what? And so we won't be able to tell exactly what it's made of. We can tell you what all the choices are that it could be made of. We won't be able to tell you what exactly it's made of.
But if you have some plausible ideas of what planets ought to be made of, they ought to be made of iron and silicates and rock, rather than being made of uranium and xenon, just by what's out there in the...
Exactly. Well, we agree that it's made of roughly three different things. Silicates and rocks together, an iron core, and perhaps water in the outer layers. But with those three things, there's an ambiguity based on a given average density. Let's take an example. You could have a planet with some amount of iron in the core, silicate in the mantle, and water outer layer, or for that exact same planet to be an average given average density, it could be made of something that has a lot less silicate, but then more iron and more water, because approximately the average densities of iron and water together are that of silicate.
Hmm. Now, this is a bummer to some extent, because you'd say, well, so you won't know anything, but it is not that bad, we hope, and we expect as theorists that it is actually better than that, in the sense that there will be correlations between how much iron and silicate and water there are in different families of planets. But the only way in which we will know those correlations is by observing many planets, not just one or two. So if you give us one planet, give us the mean density for one planet, there is this ambiguity. If you give us many planets, like Kepler will, then we hope to see those correlations. That is to see that there are families of planets, families with large iron cores, other planets with small iron cores or no iron cores at all. And that will teach us about this.
In other words, to get enough numbers that the statistics really start to tell you something about the planets throughout the universe, not just the few that you happen to find.
But even for a given planet, if it's actually small enough and low enough mass, we can tell you with confidence that it is what we call a terrestrial planet that is mostly made of rock.
Precisely. Yes, so we will know. When we find the sister Earth, we will know it.
And one thing that really strikes me, too, about the hot Jupiters that are known to transit, I guess there's several dozen of them now. These are these massive planets close into their stars. There's one planet, HD 149026, that has something like 65 or 70 Earth masses in a solid core made of heavy elements. But then there's other planets that seem to be very puffed up that are predominantly hydrogen and helium. So I guess we're already getting a sense that among Jupiter mass planets, there's a tremendous variety. So I guess it's safe to say that with smaller planets, they're going to be all over the map.
I think we would argue they would have even more diversity.
You would expect to have more diversity because you have at least three components, three types of materials, which makes even four, while for giant planets it's really mostly two. And so we are expecting a lot of surprises, and that's great.
You mentioned atmosphere, studying atmospheres. How can this be done?
Right now we have one way to study atmospheres of solar system-aged planets, and that is transiting planets, the planets that go in front of the star and behind the star. We talked before about how hard it is to block out the starlight and look at a planet on its own, but in this way we don't have to separate the planet and star on the sky. We use the starlight to our advantage, and we have when the planet goes in front of the star, some of the light from the star shines through the atmosphere.
Skimming through the edge.
Yeah,
just like shining a flashlight through a fog. And so we can look at that and figure out what's in the planet's atmosphere. And this has been done successfully with the Hubble Space Telescope and with Spitzer Space Telescope. We also have when the planet goes behind the star, the planet disappears and then reappears. And we can also use that to figure out what the planet's atmosphere
from its reflected
like.
Light or its heat emission.
The reflected light is usually way too faint. But I just want to say that the whole problem scales. For small planets, we'll be able to do this experiment again, because right now we can only do it for big, hot Jupiters, with a new telescope called the James Webb Space Telescope. So we're eagerly waiting for it to launch, which should be around 2013.
And there could be, for example, rocky planets that maybe transit around small, very small stars known as red dwarfs or M dwarfs, and you could do this study. And because the red dwarfs are put out much less light and heat than the sun, the habitable zone moves closer in where the probability of transit increases. I mean, is it conceivable that in the not too distant future, we could find transiting small rocky planets around these red dwarf stars and maybe see indications in their atmospheres of possible life?
Absolutely. I would say it's fair to say the race is on to find one of those transiting planets. And we think one of them may be found any day.
Yes.
Our colleague, Dave Charbonneau, a professor at Harvard, has a program going on where he's looking at M stars, looking for transits. Our other friends and colleagues are looking for the radial velocity, the wobble method, to look for these small planets and then follow up with photometry to look for transits. So this is happening, and people are working hard to get a pool of these objects that later we can look at with JWST.
And Bob, this is indeed the ultimate goal. We want to be able to study what's in the atmospheres of those planets. And transits are really the best way to go about it because of what Sarah explained. And so one of the goals, and Sarah and I work with a big team based both at MIT and Harvard, is to build a space telescope which will follow up on Kepler and really try to concentrate on the transiting planets that are closest to the Earth in the vicinity of the solar system. We call it TESS. It's been already awarded phase one funds from NASA for eventually, hopefully, selection. And that will be a mini Kepler mission, however, one that is going to concentrate on transiting planets in the vicinity, including around small stars. And these are the potential targets for the successor of Hubble.
In other words, stars that are relatively close to the sun as opposed to Kepler's field of view, which includes very faint ones very far away.
So bright stars.
Bright stars, and hence brighter planets.
Which gives you more of a signal if you are trying to image the planet, but make the planet appear farther away from the star, and also more of a signal of the spectrum of its atmosphere. And why is the atmosphere of some planets so exciting?
For several reasons, but the main reason is because on our own Earth, we have biosignature gases that fill the atmosphere that can be detected remotely.
These are gases that are produced only by life on Earth, and in the absence of life on Earth, they wouldn't exist, right?
That's the main goal, and that on our own Earth is oxygen and its photochemical byproduct ozone.
So if you were looking from many light years away and you discovered this tiny little blue dot of Earth, that would be the first signature that you could reasonably expect to find that there was living things here?
I have two comments. One is that it's still difficult to find oxygen. It's pretty narrow band. What is easier to find is water vapor. You know, on our own Earth, water vapor is the major greenhouse gas. We don't always hear about that because we don't control it anthropogenically like we do the other greenhouse gases. But water has a big, big signature. And water vapor in the atmosphere of a small planet is indicative of liquid water oceans. All life on Earth needs liquid water, so we want to find a planet that has evidence for liquid water. I think that the work that has been done so far on biosignatures is extremely terracentric. We're like the person looking for our drop keys, but only looking under the lamppost. So what we're really looking for dates back to James Lovelock and another person named Lederberg, who said what we want to find is an atmosphere that's completely out of chemical equilibrium, that has some signature that's so different than anything we expect that requires us to follow up and dig down to see if that is actually produced by life.
And by out of chemical equilibrium, you mean that there has to be some ongoing process that is making this stuff, because just left to itself, it would dissipate or decay.
Exactly.
And in the case of Earth and oxygen, that is photosynthesis from all those green plants around us that are making the oxygen.
But on another planet, there could be some totally different chemical process.
That are making chlorine what might be some examples?
You can think about it in terms of excluding what wouldn't work. If I detect on a planet free oxygen and methane at the same time, and you look at this spectrum and show it to a chemist, the chemist will tell you, there is something that doesn't match up here. You can't have both of them month after month, year after year on this planet. It's just impossible. Why? Because there is some other agent, which is biochemistry, that is producing one versus the other and brings the entire atmosphere out of chemical equilibrium. So by understanding the planetary chemistry well enough, the one without life, then you can go and see signatures which fall outside of the box. And that, in the case of the Earth, we know is an indication of life.
Now, for these exoplanets, we may not be fortunate enough to see every single chemical signature there. For example, methane is much harder to detect than oxygen or water. It just has a smaller spectroscopic signature. So even if there are aliens far away looking back at Earth and they see oxygen without seeing methane, they could still be relatively sure, perhaps not 100%, that something unusual that can be attributed to life is going on here, because oxygen is such a reactive gas, it's very hard for it to stay in the atmosphere.
And this whole question about looking for life on planets outside of Earth, you know, we have the quest, you know, especially maybe doing eventually a sample return mission from Mars. People are interested in some of the icy moons of the outer solar system like Europa and Enceladus. And at the same time, we have this quest to find life-bearing planets around other stars. You don't have a crystal ball in front of you, but if you had to venture your best guess, do you think it's more likely we'll find evidence of extraterrestrial life inside the solar system or outside the solar system first?
Well, it's a difficult question. I think we may be lucky and find it on Mars. Mm-hmm. I hope we do. Maybe Titan. It's so much easier to study samples from Mars. But you have to understand, our backyard is our backyard. And what we find in our backyard may not tell us much about life in the universe. Mm-hmm. We have to go out there. We have to find other planetary systems and study those Earth-like planets there and understand their geochemistry and try to find those unusual atmospheres and hence, hopefully, life. Because that is going to tell us more about life in the universe than what we find in our own backyard.
I fully agree and summarize it by saying the difference between looking for life in our solar system and looking for life beyond our solar system is one of quality versus quantity. So in our own solar system, we could ultimately, as the years and centuries and millennia go by, humans can look in incredible detail. But if life isn't here in the solar system, we won't find it. However, for other planets, we know that there are 100 or more stars we can look at in the near future, thousands of stars with planets that we could look at. And in our own galaxy, we have hundreds of billions of stars. So ultimately, the chance for humans to look for signs of life just increases going beyond our solar system. So if I have to venture a guess, I would say that ultimately it will be found beyond our solar system.
Based on the number of planets that have been found so far and their distribution of masses and distances, how many planets, the Milky Way has a couple hundred billion stars, you know, how many planets are there in the Milky Way? Do we have like maybe several planets per star on average? This is, I know we're getting to very speculative territory here, but how many life-bearing planets might we have in our galaxy?
Well, what's amazing is that give us 4 years after Kepler's been up for a while, and we can answer that question quite precisely.
Yes, I agree. Give us 4 years.
Okay.
But in the meantime, if you want the number, based on the current statistics, you end up with something like 100 million Earth-like planets in the habitable zones of stars in the Milky Way galaxy.
100 million.
Yes.
Well, that's quite a bottom line number if it holds up. So I guess, folks, you'll just have to keep subscribing to Sky and Telescope for the next 4 years, and we will bring it all to you.
and we'll tell you all about the Kepler results.
Yes. Go Kepler.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dimitar and Sarah. Thanks for visiting with us and telling us about your research and about the latest discoveries on extrasolar planets and what we can look forward to in the future.
You're very welcome.
Very welcome. It's a pleasure.